Hi, I'm Claire Morrow. I began doing elder care work when my own parents started to falter and needed help, but I live very far away. In the beginning, I was trying to reach out to them and manage their situation. Even though I did have a sister who lived much closer, I was concerned, I wanted to help, and I was kind of making myself crazy because I didn't live nearby and it was very hard to do anything. But I'm an action-oriented person. If I see a problem, I like to think of a way to address it and go ahead and do that. And so I realized after I'd visited my parents and my dad was in a rehab for a stroke at the time, that there were problems that all elderly people or people who were becoming older were having with coping with the next phase of their lives. And because I had a counseling background and a programming outreach background, I began to work with my local elder services because I thought I can't always be there to help my parents, but I can help other people who are dealing with these problems. And that gave me a sense of purpose, and that's how I got into the industry. It's not just health workers who have this elder care, who have options within elder care, right? It's a broad brush. So it's health professionals at every level, skilled and unskilled. Those are the people who interact directly with like everyday care, with health needs, and then there are all the support people who are caregivers, like respiratory therapists who are so important right now, and all the other technology-based occupations that address that. Then activities, which we sort of already have talked about with the art therapy and other ways to promote mental activity and social engagement within a community. But now, within those communities, a lot of them are self-distancing within the community. So each person is isolated within their space. They're not allowed to leave their room, or if they are and they are ambulatory, they're not supposed to congregate, same as in the outside community. And they may see one caregiver all day long. So thinking about what kind of engagement do they have, the activities director may come like room to room with an activity to engage the person for like a playtime, you know? So one person goes in the room and they get their nails done. Or one person goes in the room with some art materials and interacts with them around it. But, you know, the entertainment, like I mentioned previously, I have seen examples where people go into they move into their doorways of a common corridor, and the entertainment is displayed on a screen at the end of the hall, or someone comes through and tries to encourage a sing along, but since outside providers who would normally be contracted to come into the facility are not, the staff has to improvise, and they have other duties. So this, you know, in this type of engagement, enriched engagement, is not really part of their highest priorities. So this is something that's falling aside, and as a result, people are losing out on that sense of engagement. And I am afraid, from my perspective, because I've had loved ones in this situation, that they are left to feel like objects, you know, and they lose a sense of their own humanity. And one of the other types of engagement that a lot of communities utilize is the pet therapy, because the animal-human engagement is another way that you can reach people at a deeper level if they've shut down other levels. Now, we're not hugging each other. We're not engaged with very much touch. I mean, within a facility, I'm sure there's someone helping with bathing. That's a very intimate touch aspect of care that if you can do it yourself, you're not getting. And I think, to digress just a point, I think this is why people are so obsessed about the hairdresser and the barber, because if you have no other physical contact in your life, if you live alone, you don't have a partner relationship, you don't have family members to give you a hug, the only person touching you is that person who brushes your hair and cuts it. And maybe, at a nice salon, you get a scalp massage or a hand massage or even a shoulder massage to go with your service of a haircut. So all of that really means a lot to people. So without that, when you have a pet that you can interact with, you pet them, they brush up to you, they interact with you, they sleep next to you, they're always there. And that kind of sense memory is something that lingers if you have an elderly person who's short-term memory is degrading for whatever reason, they can access those comforting feelings of closeness with a living being. And at a certain point, our humanity is aligned with all living beings. So the closeness of a pet therapist in the form of a dog or a cat, and in a lot of cases it can be other animals, a bird, a hamster. People have all sorts of pets, but that bond, if it's embedded, can be reignited in a comforting way. And that's why in facilities they often have a stuffed animal therapy practice as well as a live animal visitation, or in certain cases, an animal resident who's considered an RA, a resident animal within the facility, the same way that students often have a resident advisor in their dorm who's like an older, senior, more experienced comfort person that you can go to with problems. Well, the resident animal might just be a familiar home-like touch, depending on the animal. I've been in nursing homes where they have a resident cat. And of course, not all animals are suited to this, but in this case, I believe that the animal was tended by office personnel who are pretty much there on a regular basis and are not taken up with immediate duties of caregiving to the patients or the other residents. And that animal, just had free reign of the public rooms, at least from what I could see. And everybody knew that cat, and everybody was generally, had a smile for that cat. And on the days that the pet therapy dog team showed up, I could never find that cat when I walked through to the place where I was giving a program. The bus would come, and a team of small dogs and their handlers. A lot of them were golden retrievers, or you know, like in a younger stage where they were in close contact with a handler, and they came in a group, and they just would take up residence in a public space, and any other resident could come in and interact with those animals for a period of time. They came as a team to visit. Now, this can be done in a lot of different ways. I've certainly heard of places that would actually allow a visitor to come in with an animal to someone in a rehab facility, so that they would have visit time with their dog. I've witnessed that, and the dog was so happy to be with the elder, she just laid down underneath the bed and listened to the conversation that surrounded them. Now, I'm sure not every facility would, you know, in normal times would allow this, but right now, every pet has to come with a handler, and those people are not entering into the facility. So that is another aspect of engagement that's missing. But one thing that's particularly common right now are always comforting are pet videos, just in general. People love posting the antics of their pet, and each of us gets some kind of a thrill sharing that and viewing those. You get, if you have an affinity for a certain type of animal or even any animal, when we see them behaving, we relate to it in a way that is, I think, connecting with our commonality. I mean, human behavior has certain patterns. Animal behavior has certain patterns. Sometimes we can uncannily recognize those patterns of behavior in animals that we identify with unconsciously, because they mimic to our eye something that humans do. I wonder if it's the same in reverse. When people are deprived of that kind of content, what can you do? So pet therapy handlers, or pet handlers who are therapists, however you want to think about these, the people who accompany the pet to deliver that comfort, mm-hmm. to individuals, mm-hmm. they are now producing their own videos that work with a sense of addressing an individual patient. So if they know that at a certain facility there are people who always interact with those pets when they come, they can make a video that addresses the conditions in that community or the past interactions that they've had in that community, and offer them in a way that allows a person, you know, through a remote, through an online remote connection, to interact in a live way, as well as a specific maybe video of a previous interaction, or gathering pets and allowing them, gathering the animals who are familiar with each other, say from this pet theme, and allowing them to interact and sharing that interaction with their fellow, with the resident communities that they visit, so that patients can see their favorite animal like a family member. People are becoming more innovative as they realize that this situation is not going to resolve quickly, mm-hmm. and that we have to come up with these alternate ways of addressing it, because these are aspects of mental health. I mean, if you believe what the kind of statistics that are starting to come out from less formal surveys, many people are anxious and depressed, whether they're in nursing homes or not. And pets are flying off the shelves, so to speak. Shelters are empty. Well, I think that there's an important component to pet visitors in residential communities that has to do with the actual physical contact with the animal that's really hard to duplicate with substitute stuffed animals or plush toys, or even you can use fur throws or something made of feathers, like a shawl, feathery shawl or something like that, to add the textural element of an animal, but the interaction itself really can't be replaced. So having the ability to receive animals back into the facility would be a tremendous boost for the relationships. Presumably, the process of re-engagement outside would mean that visitors, you know, family members could possibly visit even before pets. I don't know how these interactions from outside will be managed, but I can imagine it would be some sort of triage of steps that integrate services back into a nursing facility, or even an independent living community would have restrictions, I would think, around that. But in independent living communities, you may already have your own pet. The issue is most higher level nursing facilities cannot accommodate a pet with a patient entering a new community member. So they have to be given up at some point, which, you know, presents its own problems. And that can be very difficult. I imagine it would be very positive is the short answer to your question. I can't imagine a person who wouldn't smile at the entry of one of these very happy, obedient, beautifully groomed golden retrievers that come to visit. It's really complicated to address increased deaths in nursing homes. Mental health conditions, as I referred to, the recent surveys of the general population that look at anxiety and depression have physical corollaries. So depressed people sometimes they overeat as a result of depression and anxiety. Sometimes people stop eating. So certainly that aspect of a lack of stimulation that causes apathy about your existence and maybe speeds up your withdrawal from life around you, and a desire to retreat so far within yourself that you lose the ability to sustain life. It's really hard to address loneliness and the effects of loneliness on individuals if you can't reach them. And I think that this is part of the frustration that family members have right now with the situation of closed nursing facilities, especially, and the absolute, you know, it's even hard to talk about this, the common occurrence of people dying without the presence of their loved ones is so devastating for family and even unrelated people to imagine in that situation that no one really wants to think about it, but it's happening over and over again in these ICUs. So within a nursing home situation, if you have wings of the facility that are for terminal patients who may have chosen not to that there are basic studies that involve infants and those who thrive and those who don't can depend on how much physical contact they receive. So if they're, I mean, certainly you can die from not having your needs met, but there's more to it than that because you need to feel that you're not, that you're cared for. And the physical touch aspect of our existence is often underestimated. And when we underestimate physical touch, it becomes a lower priority in the sense of how the positive nature of it as an expression in general. And it's controversial because physical touch can be wanted or unwanted. And but in certain kinds of caregiving circumstances, it's necessary. Like if you can't any longer bathe yourself, then you need assistance to do that so that you're clean and healthy, and it makes the interaction, the process of getting in the shower and coming out is a therapeutic one to a certain extent that we use every day as part of our own caregiving. So when animals are present with people, they have not only the sense that the animal is there for them, they are there for the animal. And at a very basic level, if there are no people around, then you're receiving something really positive. If you have no one tending you, then your usual caregiver in this examples that you gave, maybe even if in this community other people brought them food, or it wouldn't be the same as having that family closeness. And the same with long-term partners. You could come to visit them every single day, sit down and spend time with them, bring them food, make sure they had plans for the evening, as an example. But it wouldn't be the same as having a partner there to monitor and to share with you the simple process of going about your day. And you would also have no one who needed you. See, I think that receiving care has to have some sort of reciprocalness to it. That's why in caregiving, it's often not separated, but referred to as a care partner team, because the person giving care is also receiving care. And if you are accepting care from someone, it is almost, in my estimation, it behooves you to recognize that person, to know their name, to ask them how they're doing, to thank them for their care, whatever basic care they may be providing. Even if, you know, whether it's delivering a meal, it's having a greeting for them, sharing something about the day, accepting the food they offer you, and the effort that they made to bring it to you, whatever that might be. If it's the person who is assisting you with something of a much more personal nature, you know, in the hair salon example, we have, you know, a conversation. If we go to the same person all the time, we have a kind of personal relationship. There's that aspect of the gratuity at the end that is also an acknowledgement of service. If we feel like, well, if I'm not going there, what's happening with that person? That connection is lost. Then, you know, we look for other ways to tend it. And I think that without those relationships in our lives that are so basic to everyday life, we are all somewhat at a loss, you know, because we're affiliative people. So I'm not surprised. I think it's a metaphor, and it's a valid one, that you could pine away for lack of someone's company. If you look at human behavior from a more like anthropological point of view, then communities of the past or tribal communities that still exist also, you know, what do? And they eject people from their community that transgress or, you know, can't fit in, or, you know, some aspect of, or they choose to leave and cut themselves off deliberately and find, you know, and have to find new communities. And this can cause all sorts of disruptive issues for the individual, because if it's your birth community, you know, what replaces that? And, you know, it becomes a struggle of affiliation with something outside that. And, you know, these things have patterns to them, these repercussions of affiliation have patterns to them that, you know, draw parallels all over the place. I mean, this is part of the issue with lots of abuses of power in relationships, that when you have a connection that also delivers some form of value, then it's hard to break it, even when it's destructive for you as an individual. You can know that, but you can also fear the disconnection. And, you know, I think this is part of what we need. We all are concerned about on a certain level as humans, and why some people are reacting so strongly to the idea of ending social distancing. And it's not unexpected, but it raises the point that, you know, I mean, it draws into question what is the greater good, and that is something that really interests me. Is how can people grapple with their own needs and also make choices for the greater good? That's, you know, there are always people who will do that, but not everyone. And that's just because, to my way of thinking, it's the tension that always exists between the individual and the other, or the other group. And some cultures have stronger ingrained values about always prioritizing the good of the group over the individual. And it's a continuum. You're all, that as an individual, we're always balancing. Do I make this choice for myself, or do I choose what's good for the group? So on a basic level, if I've got $5 extra, do I buy something just for me, or do I buy something I can share with my family? Very simple kind of choice question, but it reflects something really deep within our humanity. When I visited my grandma in a nursing home when I was in college, which would have been in the 70s, she was in one of these old-fashioned, she was sitting in one of these old-fashioned iron bedsteads in a large room that was lined with these beds. And we went to visit her, and I mean, it was totally shocking to me. First of all, she didn't even look like my grandma. She had like industrial glasses on, and she looked completely shrunken. And I'd always previously seen her with her hair curly, and she just had, you know, a man's haircut. And she couldn't remember who my dad was, her oldest son, and she certainly had no idea who I was. And it was how my father didn't break down, I don't know. He just tried to be his, you know, a cheerful version of himself. But I think, you know, it was a struggle for all of us. And she was being taken care of by one of his sisters who made this decision, with or without consensus, I don't know. He lived in another state by this time, so he wasn't able to, my parents had retired to Florida, and, you know, my aunt made this decision, and that's how it was. And, you know, I mean, it was certainly a facility run by, that was by extension related to the best hospital in the area where they live, but it still, when I think of that term, warehousing the elderly, in my mental image is that iron bedstead and my grandmother in the bed, you know, like barely sitting up. Mm-hmm. And I thought, you know, like, does she ever get out of there? We do have to have these experiences. We have to see the situation for ourselves, feel it, I think, in our own experience on some level, to have it, to appreciate what the consequences of our choice are.